Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Botulinum toxin is mostly known for its cosmetic uses, but to rehabilitation physicians and other doctors, botulinum toxin is a treatment of choice for patients with spasticity due to cerebral palsy or following a stroke or other neurological disorders. At the moment, botulinum toxin is on the PBS, but only for a specific set of indications. In a perspective published by the MJA on the 29th of January 2018, Dr. Anupam Dattagupta and Dr. David Wilson argue that the time has come for the PBS to widen its indications for the use of botulinum toxin for spasticity. Dr. Gupta is a rehabilitation specialist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide and a senior lecturer at the University of Adelaide. He is my special guest today. Let's start out with the basics. Tell us about spasticity. When does it occur, and what is the burden of spasticity for patients?
In the simplest terms, spasticity means increased tightness of muscles due to upper motor neuron lesion. The widely accepted definition was given by an Australian neurologist, Dr. James Lance, in 1980 as a velocity-dependent increase in resistance as a result of hyper-excitable stretch reflexes. Mm-hmm. Another definition is disordered sensory motor control resulting from an upper motor lesion presenting as intermittent or sustained involuntary activation of muscles. Clinically, spasticity manifests as paradoxical consequences, like increase in the muscle tone caused by the increased resistance offered by the muscles to passive stretching, plus knife phenomenon, increased tendon reflexes, clonus, flexor and extensor spasms. These are all examples of positive upper motor signs. The negative consequences caused by spasticity could be weakness, impaired coordination, impaired motor control, planning, and easy fatigue. These positive and negative consequences actually emerge, evolve, and interact with each other, resulting in a dynamic clinical presentation. The mechanism of spasticity is there's abnormal intraspinal processing causing abnormal regulation of the spinal reflex and imbalance descending regulation involving different tracts, such as corticospinal tracts, which originates from the cortex. But the newer research shows that involvement of other tracts, such as reticulospinal, vestibulospinal, rubrospinal, coming from the brainstem, contribute to the negative symptoms, which I have just described. The central lesion actually disrupts the balance of supraspinal inhibitory and excitatory inputs directed to the spinal cord, leading to a state of a disinhibition of the stretch reflexes. Whereas dystonia, which is commonly associated, is a bit different, and it is jerking and twisting involuntary contractions of the limbs, which can occur in isolation or at times can accompany spasticity. Now, in your question of when does it occur, spasticity occurs as a classical clinical manifestation in a wide variety of neurological conditions such as stroke, cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, multiple sclerosis, brain tumors, cerebral infections, and encephalopathies. Dystonia is most commonly seen in Parkinson's disease or in isolation or in association of spasticity. Now, in your question of burden of spasticity, the epidemiological, humanistic, and economic burden of spasticity is quite substantial. The exact overall prevalence of spasticity is not known, but it is estimated that 28 to 38% patients in stroke, 41 to 69% patients in multiple sclerosis, 19 to 92% patients with cerebral palsy, and 13% patients with traumatic brain injury can experience spasticity. For example, stroke, which is one of Australia's biggest killers and leading cause of disability, and the third most common cause of disability in the developed world, Last year, in 2017, there were 55,000 new and recurrent strokes, 1,000 strokes every week. About 65% of the stroke survivors suffer disability. So of that percentage, 30% can develop spasticity. So that is a big number. At a personal level, spasticity can be painful. There is increased tone, which can cause abnormal posture, resulting in decline and eventual loss of function. Mm-hmm. In the upper limb, functions such as washing, dressing, feeding, and other aspects of activities of daily living can be adversely affected. In the lower limb, walking is one of the highest priorities for the people living with stroke. And as you know, human walking is bipedal, which is, we stand on both feet, followed by a period of single stands on one limb, while the other limb is swung forward.
Mm-hmm.
And patients with stroke, they develop a deformity known as equinovarus deformity, which is inwards and downwards turning of the ankle and the foot caused by the spastic muscles. And they are unable to achieve proper contact with the floor, resulting in poor stance. They lose the heel-toe rhythm of walking. This awkward posturing of foot and spasticity impairs balance, transfers, stride, gait, and overall mobility.
Mm.
And many patients have to opt for residential care because they cannot transfer and walk. Other body parts also can be affected by spasticity, such as spastic cervical dystonia. The complications of spasticity could be contracture, which is permanent shortening of the muscle,
mm-hmm.
falls, and fracture. The treatment cost goes exponentially up in these circumstances. Coming to the quality of life, spasticity has detrimental and damaging effects on quality of life. There was a survey on a site called WeMove where 589 people were surveyed, and they indicated that limited range of motion, stiffness or contracture, limitation in ADL were the causes of poor quality of life. But there is paucity of data from the studies aimed at evaluating quality of life. Inability to walk in post-stroke lower limb spasticity contributes to poor quality of life in stroke survivors. Not only that, there is increased caregiver burden also proved through carer burden scale. And lastly, coming to the economic cost, the direct cost for patients with post-stroke spasticity are four times more compared to those without spasticity.
Yeah.
Research has shown that botulinum toxin plus physiotherapy was by far the most cost-effective therapy compared to physiotherapy alone, which was 10 times more costly. And the oral medication such as baclofen plus therapy, which was 3 times more expensive.
Mm.
So in summary, the burden of spasticity or post-stroke spasticity in terms of treatment cost, quality of life, caregiver burden, and on the consequences such as falls and fractures are significant.
How did botulinum toxin come to be the treatment of choice? How does it bring such relief?
Botulinum toxin has emerged as the drug of choice for focal spasticity and dystonia. The toxin acts on the muscles involving the arm and leg or other areas by selectively blocking the release of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. The effect of botulinum toxin is realized in 3 to 7 days and can last up to 4 months. It has been shown to be safe and effective and better tolerated through several class 1 studies. In other words, randomized placebo-controlled trials. Before the advent of botulinum toxin, the treatment of spasticity consisted of physiotherapy, stretching, casting, strengthening, plus oral anti-spasticity medications such as baclofen, tizanidine, dantrolene, diazepam, and injection of neurolytic agents such as phenol. Patients are less tolerant of these centrally acting medications and experience side effects such as sedation, confusion, cognitive problem, loss of seizure control, etc. The side effects can cause serious consequences such as aspiration and falls, due to confusion and cognitive problems. These dealt the final blow to the notion that the oral antispastic medications should be tried first before botulinum toxin. The toxin is emerging also as an important intervention, providing the window of opportunity for other therapies such as physiotherapy and bracing to work. RCTs have shown that toxin is safe, effective in ameliorating spasticity, and is better tolerated, and it reduces pain. With the quality of life, there is a strong evidence that treatment with botulinum toxin decreases spasticity significantly in stroke survivors. It is not clear that these improvements are associated with improvement of active function and quality of life. Failure to see improvements in quality of life could be due to the fact that the traditional global quality of life measures are not sensitive enough to capture the impact of botulinum toxin, which is a focal intervention. It is an injection just.
Yes.
It has been argued that any improvement in the quality of life items may be lost in the overall noise of the unchanging items. Therefore, appropriate goals are being set and newer outcomes are measured nowadays. One such example is goal attainment scales or GAS goals, which are reported to be more responsive to the toxin injection. Having said that, botulinum toxin treatment should not be considered in isolation, but it is a part of a comprehensive strategy involving physiotherapy and bracing in a multidisciplinary setting.
What are the current pharmaceutical benefit scheme indications for botulinum?
So the current PBS indications are dynamic equinus deformity due to spasticity in ambulant cerebral palsy, patients with cerebral palsy, age 2 to 17 years, and in patients over 18 years, if they were commenced on treatment as child. And in upper limb spasticity in children with cerebral palsy aged 2 to 17 years inclusive and over 18 years of age, if commenced treatment as a child. And moderate to severe spasticity defined by MAS, M-A-S, or modified Ashworth scale of 3 or more in post-stroke spasticity, but it is restricted to 4 doses per limb. So we are not sure what is the scientific rationale for this restriction, actually.
And it leaves a lot of people unable to get the care, doesn't it?
Yeah, they continue to get benefit, but we struggle because they are not approved by PBS.
I know in your paper you mentioned that there's been an attempt to persuade the PBAC to widen the indications. What was the result of that?
There has been efforts from the Rehabilitation Medicine Society of Australia and New Zealand to widen and expand this indication. So Rehabilitation Medicine Society of Australia and New Zealand put up a position statement in 2013 on the therapeutic use of botulinum toxin in rehabilitation medicine for spasticity and dystonia, and pointed out the emerging evidence and cost-benefit analysis, and also indicated botulinum toxin treatment as part of a coordinated multidisciplinary approach. And then again in 2017, we put up another statement. I was part of that expert committee, and the position statement indicated the confusing range of approved indications and decisions regarding funding for botulinum toxin by therapeutic TGA and PBS. There is a strong opinion that many of the current funding restrictions are not reflective of the modern best practice. Botulinum toxin is used more widely for a larger number of conditions than the PBS-approved conditions. The Therapeutic Goods Administration accepts the use of botulinum toxin as appropriate in circumstances that the PBS does not cover. In certain circumstances, work cover insurers subsidize the treatment. There's a encouraging research evidence as well as extensive clinical experience supporting more widespread use of botulinum toxin in different indications. And Rehabilitation Medicine Society of Australia and New Zealand is applying to CBSE in this regard, but nothing has eventuated so far.
What's the next step? What else can you do?
The next step is getting the message out. I think it is important to tell the individual patient stories and narratives, which can be very useful tools.
Yes.
The narratives is often maligned as anecdotes and scrubbed from the toolbox of the guideline developers and regulatory bodies.
Yep.
But research has shown that the most effective way of espousing evidence is or disseminating and translating evidence is through narratives and individual stories. This can have uniquely persuasive effects on overcoming the preconceived beliefs and cognitive biases.
Yes.
One of the patients I described in my paper had significant palmar ulceration as the spastic fingers due to multiple sclerosis were digging into her hand. This condition is not covered by PBS. Patient exhausted all other options and was being considered for surgery. The botulinum toxin injection not only relieved the spasticity, it allowed greater opening of the hand, cleaning of the palm, and improved hand hygiene. The ulcer eventually healed completely. As everyone can imagine, conducting a randomized controlled trial is not possible in these cases due to small numbers and purely for ethical reasons. There are other ways like lobbying the government, get support from the different societies such as neurologists, because most of these patients are neurological patients, orthopedic surgeons, because they also treat young kids with cerebral palsy, and possibly geriatricians. Engage different patients and organizations such as Stroke Association, Parkinson's Associations, and MS Society into it. An application to PBSE indicating the emerging evidence from the studies prescribed in Australia and overseas. Most importantly, embarking on newer studies incorporating the ICF model, built evidence on the works of other peers in Australia and overseas, and collaborating with them. And in the interim, it is important that the multidisciplinary spasticity clinics continue to collect real-life data and record the outcomes. Data collection by the clinics should be based on goals established by the patient and the team, considering functional ability, quality of life, carer burden, etc. Besides measuring the reduction of spasticity, functioning should be measured as per ICF, or International Classification of Functioning Guidelines.
Is there talk of having a registry at all for spasticity?
There was a registry. I was part of that study called PROS study, Patients Outcome Registry in Spasticity, by a professor called Professor Alberto Eskenazi from Albert Einstein Institute of Medical Science in Philadelphia.
Yep.
And they have published their work. And all these registries actually indicate positive outcomes of using the toxin in different spastic conditions.
What's the difference between what the ICF program recommends and what the PBS is actually doing?
PBS recommendations are, I think, quite old, and they are not in tune with the current understanding of human functioning, because International Classification of Functioning is promoted as a biopsychosocial model, and ICF broadly takes into account impairments, which is problems in the body function or alteration in body structure, for example, spasticity, and activity limitations, which are difficulties in executing functions such as walking, eating, etc., and participation restrictions, such as facing discrimination in employment and transportation. ICF considers the interaction between an individual with a health condition and the individual contextual factors, which is environmental and the personal factors. So there is an excellent document called World Health Organization Report on Disability, which came out in 2011, and it defines rehabilitation as a set of measures that assist individuals who experience or likely to experience disability to achieve and maintain optimal functioning in interactions with their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the rehabilitation outcomes are the benefits and changes in the functioning of an individual over time. Traditionally, rehab outcome measures have focused on individuals' impairment level, such as spasticity, according to the current PBS guidelines.
Yeah.
But impairment data is not an adequate proxy for disability information. The outcome measurements should be extended to include individual activity and participation outcomes. And I think the talks are being going on. We are hopeful. I'll give you an example. Post-stroke patients, PBS allows us to use the toxin for upper limb, not for the lower limb. And we all know stroke causes hemiplegia. They are spastic in both upper and lower limb. And I have just mentioned how important is to treat spasticity for the lower limb, because lower limb is walking, functioning.
Yes.
And we are not allowed to use toxin for lower limb. And recently in 2016, the FDA has approved botulinum toxin for post-stroke lower limb spasticity based on a large phase 3 multicenter double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial. But PBS has not yet acted on that. Yeah, it has to come because PBS indications are quite restrictive in Australia with regards to use of toxin. I have mentioned several neurological conditions, and we are only allowed to use it in cerebral palsy and post-stroke upper limb, whereas TGA approves botulinum toxin for focal spasticity of any etiology. We have registered a trial with post-stroke lower limb spasticity recently. Mm-hmm. We will start recruiting from March, and we have got some funding through our Hospital Research Foundation and investigator-initiated trial grant. Hopefully. And then most of the research has been focused on quantitative study. I think we should also look at qualitative studies through structured interviews, mm-hmm. Followed by thematic analysis, and that may provide new insights.
And thank you for your time today.
Okay, thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.